Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, VOR listeners, and welcome to another hour discussing heresies. I have a full program for you tonight, so I want to get started. Last week, I talked about Ernst Zundel and Elie Wiesel. After the excitement of Zundel's release from 7 years in prison, it has been quiet on that front, but there's one tidbit from Lady Michelle Renouf, written to David Irving, as a matter of fact, in which she said something that I liked very much. And so I'm going to quote it to you now. She wrote, "Ernst stepped straight up, warmly confident, to greet each and every friend who had turned up at Mannheim Prison's gate to express their gratitude for his role model, unbowed fiber. As we drove this eagle-eyed owl to his Black Forest ancestral lair, he keenly declared on film that they used to have a critic, now they have an enemy." Well, I like that. He's coming right out with it, and they have turned not only Ernst into an enemy, but many of us. And who are they? Well, it is that Orthodox establishment that insists on having their version of history in every aspect and none other. And I'm sure he's also talking about the German government. I have a little more on Elie Wiesel from last week. We had quite a bit about Elie and Carlo Mattonio's expose about his presence or non-presence at Auschwitz and Buchenwald. I want you to look at a couple of photographs that you will find on a new blog that's called Scrapbook Pages Blog, which is a product of the person who runs the scrapbookpages.com website, which has tremendous amount of information about Germany, the concentration camps, and the Holocaust in general. The URL for this, for you to go and look for it either right now or at a later time, is http://furtherglory.wordpress.com. And on the March 2nd entry, it's entitled Famous Photo of Buchenwald Survivors. And on it, you will find several photographs of great interest. The very famous photograph of the emaciated prisoners in Barrack 56 at Buchenwald, taken on April 16th, 1945. This is the one where Elie Wiesel is sticking his face out, or supposedly Elie Wiesel, in the rear of the picture, and the very skinny man is standing there. It's a very famous photograph, and there are three versions of it on here, or two, and then one that's a detail. So you can see, and it describes which person is Elie Wiesel, if you're not familiar with this photograph already. And I want you to know first that Elie identified himself here. He's not identified by anyone else or anything else, but he's identified himself. Also, the person in the very front of the picture on the lower bunk is our friend Miklos Gruner, who we talked about last week, who is the one who accuses Elie of being an imposter and taking the tattoo number of his friend Lazar Wiesel. But I want you to compare the so-called Elie's face in this picture with another picture below that, in this March 2nd blog, of the Buchenwald orphans being marched out of the camp on April 27th, 1945. So this was 10 days after the other picture was taken, and Elie Wiesel has identified himself as the boy in the back of the group of youngsters who's wearing a dark hat. And he's much taller than anyone else. He's the tallest one in the picture. And he's on the first line, so you can't miss him. And also, he's identified here on the blog. So if you look at those two so-called pictures of Elie Wiesel when he was 16 years old, they don't look anything alike. The one doesn't look like the other. I dare anyone to say, when they look at that and say honestly, oh yes, I can see that these two are the same person. The boy in the, with the orphans looks like he's about 15, 16, something like that. The man in the other, in the barracks photograph, looks like he's in his 20s. And in any event, they don't look anything alike. There's another picture at the bottom of that blog, which is very interesting. This was taken on April 14th, 3 days after the liberation, where they have gathered together a whole group of liberated Buchenwald prisoners who look very healthy. You can hardly imagine a group of healthier, more fit-looking people, and they've got them all packed into that one barracks to make it look like it's overcrowded. But that's a very interesting blog. And these pictures of Elie Wiesel, that where he has identified himself as a prisoner at Buchenwald at this time, tell us that, cause us to question even more. It's more evidence that this is not him and he wasn't there. Now, I talked about his sisters last week, and I didn't have much. I kind of dropped it because there really hasn't much to say about them. I've looked and looked for information about these two sisters of Elie Wiesel, Hilda and Beatrice. The story goes that they were also deported to Auschwitz at the same time, and they survived. And they were reunited with Elie in France after the war, and then all three of them traveled or emigrated to the United States, and Beatrice eventually emigrated to Canada, where she currently supposedly still lives in Montreal. And yet, that's it. There's nothing about these two women. If they were truly Auschwitz survivors, they have a story to tell. Why aren't they telling their story? Obviously, because they don't have a story, because they weren't there. And Elie wasn't there either. But he doesn't mind making up his story. And they don't interfere. They stay very much in the background. And it's as if the internet is conspiring, or all the news sources are conspiring, to keep everything quiet about these two women. And yet, they still are said, it's still said that they exist, because they feature in the book Night and in other things that Elie has written. Well, more on Elie, still, in February, was that his institute in Romania has protested against a Romanian film that has been accepted at a Berlin Film Festival. The story is that there is a Romanian film titled Portrait of the Young Man as a Fighter, and it has been entered and accepted into the Berlinale, which is a film festival, obviously, in Berlin. And the Elie Wiesel National Institute for the Study of the Holocaust in Romania has protested against the inclusion of this film because it's about anti-communists that he says are fascist and anti-Semitic, particularly the main character. It's the main character that he mostly wants to censor, because he says that the film tells a story about a group of anti-communist fighters led by a resistance fighter at the time, an anti-communist resistance fighter whose name I cannot pronounce, so I won't try to, but they hid out in the Carpathian Mountains until well into the 1950s. Supposedly they were rather brutal at times, which most resistance fighters are, and he also, I guess he expresses anti-Semitic views, this main character, at times, to some degree. But the film director says that even though this is in the film, this matches reality, but the film is not necessarily condoning that. And here's some more information about this film and these resistance fighters. There is a legionary movement that's called by people like Elie Wiesel a fascist organization in Romania, but it was actually committed to the Christian and racial renewal of the country. So, as we know, when you're sympathetic with communism, anything to do with Christian and racial renewal is considered fascist and evil. The film itself, now this is interesting, because it says that the men who went into the mountains to escape the Red Army in 1944 were a diverse assortment of nationalists, fascists, liberals, apolitical farmers, and members of the middle class who were affected by the communist expropriations. But somehow, to the Elie Wiesel National Institute for the Study of the Holocaust, these were bad people, and he does not like to see them being portrayed in a film in any way, not bad guys. Another story that has come out recently, which is not very good news, is the joining together of the Russian leader Medvedev and the Israeli leader Netanyahu for the 65th anniversary of the Allied victory over Nazi Germany. That's going to be held as a joint commemoration between Israel and Russia in May in Moscow. And it's going to be attended by thousands of Israeli war veterans. And they are coming, they have had a press conference and ahead of time and denounced attempts by particularly the Baltic countries and many Eastern European countries, their attempts to brand the Allies as conquerors and exonerate the wartime collaborators with the Nazis as freedom fighters. The Russians are very concerned. We know the Putin-Medvedev government is very concerned with stopping the revisionism of the Red Army and the communist participation during and after World War II, and is trying to rehabilitate Joseph Stalin, and therefore they have to keep Hitler and the Nazis in the place that they're in historically. So it says that they will also step up work in archives to expose and document Nazi crimes against, they say, Russians, Belarusians, Ukrainians, and Jews. I'm going to turn to an entirely different topic now, and it's the one that is my main topic for the program tonight, and that is the story of Dennis Avey. Well, first let me describe to you who Dennis Avey is. He is a World War II veteran who claims that he managed to trade places with a Jewish inmate while being held in the British POW camp near the Monowitz camp from September 1943 until January 1945. This is quite a feat, and he is portrayed as a big hero for doing this. He is now 91 years old, and he only first talked about this last year when he was 90. This news about Dennis Avey first appeared on the BBC, and you can read it on BBC Online News Magazine. It appeared in November 9th, 2009, and then it was picked up by the Mail newspaper. It used to be called the Daily Mail. I think it's now just the Mail, which published their version of this story in December of last year. And now it is running in the very prestigious Times, which ran it on February 25th. And you can Google and look up all those stories. Each of these three accounts is a little different, but the main gist of the story is the same, but the details move around quite a bit. And the changes in the story are quite telling, because the story itself, in my opinion, is a contrived story. I say this because, and I have figured out that Dennis Avey has been played up in the British media because the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem is researching Mr. Avey's story, as they say. They're doing it before they confer on him the title of Righteous Among the Nations for helping to save the life of a Jew. This is what this current flurry of publicity about Dennis Avey is all about. For those who want to look these things up, Dennis's name is spelled with one N, D-E-N-I-S, and his last name is spelled A-V-E-Y. You must understand what Righteous Among the Nations means. It's sometimes just called Righteous Gentile. It is an honor given. Actually, it's in the control of the Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial, but which is very much a part of the establishment in Israel, the government establishment and the establishment of the foundation of why the Israel state has a reason to be. And it is only for Gentiles, only for non-Jews who have saved the life of a Jew during the Holocaust. And I'm going to talk more about that later. But right now I want to introduce you to the Monowitz camp in the Auschwitz complex, because this is not always very well understood. But this plays a big part in the story that we're going to go into. Monowitz was a huge industrial complex. It was not a nice little group of barracks like Auschwitz. At Monowitz, the barracks and individual campsites were put up in 1942 to house the labor force that worked there. And Monowitz was 7 kilometers from Auschwitz. Birkenau was 3 kilometers from Auschwitz. There was quite a distance between these places. They were not just right next door to each other. And the prisoners who worked at Monowitz did not live at Auschwitz after the new barracks were built there. And the new barracks were built there in 1942. So one of the things that you're going to find wrong with A.B.'s story is that he makes it sound like prisoners were marching to and fro from these places every day. But this is not true. If the prisoners from Auschwitz had to march to Monowitz to work every day, they would be marching 14 kilometers a day, and a good part of their day would be spent in walking, not working. I'm going to take this from the Times. This is the latest rendition of his story done in the UK Times, and the author of this article is Jake Wallace Simons. Now, Simons is, you know, I cannot avoid paying attention to the to whether this is done by a Jew, because we're talking about the Holocaust. And Simon sounds like it's Jewish. Probably used to be Simon. And Jake is usually short for Jacob. I would say the odds are this writer is a Jew, is Jewish. But it doesn't say that he's a staff writer or who he is. It just has his name there. So Dennis Avey, the article reads, is currently 91, and they say he cuts a formidable figure in the article, points out what a dashing fellow he is and what a piercing glare he has, and he has the panache of Errol Flynn, and he was a former desert rat. That is, he, in 1944, broke into Auschwitz. You know, they make it very dramatic. They also point out that he has a glass eye, and when the Simons asks him what happened to his eye, A.B. tells him that in 1944, he cursed an SS officer who was beating a Jew in the camp. In return, the SS officer struck him with a pistol butt and knocked his eye in. So it starts right out telling you, if you're an astute reader or a discriminating reader, that there's something wrong here, because SS officers or guards in the camp were not able to beat up Jews, and they certainly were not able to hit British prisoners of war with their pistol butts and knock their eyes out without probably being put to death themselves. They had very strict rules in how they could treat prisoners. And then in the very second paragraph, Simons point writes this. He says, if A.B.'s story is difficult to believe, it's worth bearing in mind that it's not without precedent. And then he goes on to tell about a British POW named Charlie Coward, who had a big story and it's been made into a movie and so on. But I have to tell you that Coward is a liar and his story is not truthful. But he's pointing out here, he's concerned that you people won't believe this story because it is unbelievable. And so he makes this disclaimer right in the beginning. Now, A.B. is described as a young person, as being a rough-and-tumble fellow and a daredevil, and he describes himself this way. He said he was somewhat reckless. He would just jump into things that other people wouldn't, and this just wasn't the way he was. He also says that in 1939, when he volunteered, when he joined the British military to go to war, he was 20 years old at the time, and he says he volunteered for the army because he was too impatient to wait a week for the RAF. I mean, if you are too impatient to wait 1 week to get into the branch of service that you want to get into, there's something a little bit strange there. And yet, further on, he is described as being someone who made out this very careful, detailed plan for how to get himself into Auschwitz so he could see what was really going on. He was taken prisoner in 1942 by the Germans, and it says in the article that Avey was a troublesome prisoner. It doesn't go into any more detail about that, but obviously this was someone who didn't get along in the normal way that most people do. He was always finding himself in trouble. He was deported to Auschwitz with other POWs in 1943, and there was a camp at the periphery of the IG Farben factory. And the main Jewish camps were several miles to the west. So you must recognize that the POW camp was separate from the regular camps of the inmates. And it was several miles from the Jewish camps is what he says. But in fact, the British POW camp was near the construction site of IG Farben Buna plant. And it was only several hundred meters west of the Monowitz concentration camp. And there were 200 British POWs that arrived there in 1943. The regular labor force at Monowitz was installed there in 1942 with the new barracks. Now, quoting from the article as to what Dennis Avey says, he says this, "The stripies, that's what we call the Jewish prisoners, were in a terrible state. Within months, they were reduced to waifs, and then they disappeared. The stench from the crematoria was appalling. Civilians from as far away as Katowice were complaining. Everybody knew what was going on. Everybody knew." Well, he was not with the Jewish prisoners. So the POWs were a distance away, and they were kept separate. So he really doesn't know what kind of a state they're in. And if he knew, why did he need to go and break in to the place to find out if he already knew? So right away, he's somewhat making some somewhat contradictory statements. And I have to tell you that Katowice is quite a long ways from Auschwitz. It's a separate city, and it's at least an hour or two away from there. So you wouldn't be smelling any stench. So this is another exaggeration that he's giving. He's probably read it somewhere, because this is a common type of thing that survivors say, that you could smell the crematoria from many, many, many miles away. Yet it says here that remarkably Avey was able to think beyond the war. Well, here was a guy who never thought ahead one bit. He was very reckless, but they're trying to portray him also as someone who could think ahead of time, think far-range thoughts. And he is saying that sneaking into the camp was his idea because he knew that these swine would eventually be held to account, and so he needed to find out. He was going to find out. Just exactly so he could tell the truth about it. He exhibits extremely anti-German feelings. This man obviously saw the Nazis as the lowest of the low, and he was very eager to produce a story and produce his own witness testimony about how terrible it was at the camp. The next thing I want you to do is to go back to, eventually, when you can, to go back to the Scrapbook Pages blog, which I described earlier, and look at the March 4th entry. Here we have a story entitled, "British POW Sneaked into Auschwitz, Not Bloody Likely." Well, the Scrapbook Pages guy, what I call him, he also read that article in the Times, and he did a blog on this, and he's got some great pictures, and you need to look at these pictures to understand what's going on with Dennis Avey. The first picture on this page is actually the British prisoners of war at the POW camp at Auschwitz, which was actually by Monowitz. And you can see these men standing. This is just part of them. But this is one crew. I don't know how they were organized, but this is one crew that is had their photograph taken. And they are looking very healthy, very happy. Many of them are smiling. They look quite contented, and I'm not saying they're happy to be there, but they certainly don't look in any way like they're having any big problems. And below that is a picture of another group in their football uniforms, their football clothing. They're wearing shorts and white shirts, and they're matching white shirts. They all have an insignia on them, and they're sitting there with their guards. The SS guards are in the photograph. And they're all smiling and looking as happy as can be, and also looking extremely healthy and vigorous. So they had a soccer team, and they even had their own uniforms. Maybe the British government sent them those shirts. I'm sure the Germans wouldn't have supplied them with them, but these POWs were treated very well. Also, there's a picture below that of Jewish prisoners working in a factory at Monowitz, and you can see that these prisoners were not working under horrible conditions. They were doing ordinary kind of factory work. This is some kind of light welding that they're doing at individual tables. And so these things certainly go against the idea of what of that someone like Dennis Avey is trying to put across. We're going to take our break now. It's going to be a news break for a few minutes. Be sure to stay tuned and come back. I'll be back on the other side of the break. See you then.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
The U.S. government is considering extending its online security system, or Einstein as it's called, into the homes of Americans to prevent cyber attacks against federal networks. The program monitors who's trying to access restricted government information, but some see it as an invasion of privacy. U.S. journalist Declan McCullough says the cybersecurity threat is overhyped.
If it is written perfectly and the people running it are perfect civil servants who never decide to peek on individual network traffic, it's actually amounts to a kind of an outsourcing of security, and there's not that much of a privacy invasion. But once this infrastructure is in place, and once you have something that can watch what people are doing and perhaps block access to sites that the government doesn't like, then you have a potential for some a real civil liberties nightmare. So it all depends on the details. And if they install that on private networks, there could be some benefits. But I think that it would be unwise to just look at the benefits without looking at the dramatic downsides as well if it's used for the wrong way or falls into the wrong hands. The government has an incentive to overhype cybersecurity. You saw the administration official in the Washington Post saying, oh, this is war. It's a war on drugs. It's a war on terror. Now it's a war on cyber, I guess. So there's this incentive to hype on the part of the government, on the part of defense contractors, on the part of politicians, on the part of even some journalists to get readers. So in reality, there should be no critical infrastructure on the Internet. If it's critical, don't connect it to the Internet. There should not be power plants or nuclear power plants hooked up to the Internet. If they are, this is wrong. Let Homeland Security take a look at that instead of saying we need to eavesdrop on the Internet, even if it's just limited eavesdropping for security purposes.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We're going back to the story. It says, Avey's audacious plan was made possible by Ernst Lobethal, a German Jew from Breslau, who worked alongside Avey at the Farben factory. Well, again, they're pointing out that Avey had a plan. But Ernst Lobethal is the key person here to this story because he's the one who Avey supposedly saved. And we'll talk about how they consider that he saved Ernst Lobethal's life. But first we have to ask, did POWs and regular prisoners work together? There's no evidence that they did. They may have on certain work sites, on certain occasions, but normally they were separated. The POWs did work, and the regular prisoners worked. And there was a lot of work there at that Farben factory in that whole area. But this is rather questionable that they would have worked alongside each other. And then Avey says, or the Simon says, although fraternizing was forbidden on pain of death, the two men became friends. Well, not only did they work in the same place, but although fraternizing was forbidden, they somehow became friends. Very, very hard to figure that out. And a quote from A.B. A.B. says, "We spoke out of the corner of our mouths, a difficult thing to do in German." Well, A.B. didn't speak German, let alone speak German out of the corner of his mouth. He lived on a farm in Essex or Sussex or somewhere, and he didn't, you know, there's no way he would have been a German speaker, but he probably could have picked up some German. So he would have had some knowledge of some German words, but to carry on a conversation of the type that he would have needed to carry on with Lobethal in this hidden, you know, way where, so that the guards didn't know that they were talking to each other, then this couldn't have happened. Now, supposedly, according to the story, A.V. discovered that Lobethal had a sister living in England. Lobethal was able to tell him. He had a sister, Susanna, who had been evacuated, sort of, to England as a child. But she wasn't too young, because he was a young man, and I suppose she was a young woman. "I wrote to my mother," A.V. says, "who told Susanna that Ernst was alive, and she posted 200 cigarettes to me via the Red Cross. Miraculously, 4 months later, they arrived. The cigarettes were worth the king's ransom. Ernst suddenly became rich." This is a problem, because Susanna could very easily send cigarettes to her brother Ernst at Auschwitz, and she could send him chocolates, and she could send him anything that he needed, because they received packages via the Red Cross. He wasn't cut off. To me, this is one of the biggest giveaways that this story is fake, because they're trying to make out that Lobethal was in such a bad situation that he was just cut off from everything. He couldn't have anything. He had nothing. And this British POW could somehow receive things from the Red Cross, and then he could smuggle it in to Lobethal. In the BBC article, it says that Mr. Lobethal had told Abby that he had a sister who had escaped to England as a child, and that then, therefore, back in his own camp, Mr. Avey contacted the sister via a coded letter to his mother. Now, here again, why does he have to write a coded letter to his mother? What, this coding, how would his mother know the code if he would have to set up a code with his mother before he could write a coded letter to her? And his mother then, therefore, contacted Susanna. Well, if Lobethal knew the address of his sister Susanna in England that Avey could give to his mother to contact her, well, Lobethal could have contacted her directly. There was mail, there was postings, there were packages received. All of this went on. So this, again, is people who don't know, or who think other people don't know, and therefore will believe these stories. And then Lobethal says that he was able to buy things with the cigarettes, that is, use them for barter, and buy boots and scraps of food. And these boots and scraps of food that he saved, I guess, were what kept him alive later on the death march that he went on when all of the Auschwitz complex was evacuated by the Germans and they had marched further into Germany. And he also used these cigarettes as a bribe to help Avey gain entrance to the Jewish camp. More nonsense. Who was he bribing? He couldn't have bribed the guards, and there's no talk about that, because they explain how he supposedly got into the Jewish camp. He says that despite the danger, I knew I had to bear witness. And so he planned the operation meticulously. Again, this reckless daredevil who never planned anything, he's planning this meticulously. And his plan was this. He says he found a Dutch Jew with a similar physique and persuaded him to exchange places for a day. The Dutch Jew never has a name. And conveniently, the Dutch Jew dies later on, so that there is no Dutch Jew to be contacted or that would ever have corroborated A.B.'s story, could possibly corroborate his story. Everybody in these types of scenarios die. So that it should be noted that A.B. did not speak of this until he's 90 years old. He joined the service in 1939. He was 20. He is one of the younger ones who would have been in, you know, in his ranks. And so by the time he's 90, it's unlikely that there's any others left alive that would have known him or that he was associated with during all that time. So nobody can come forth and say, you know, I knew this guy and he was this way and that way, and I would like to see this man's military records. We don't see anything of that either, and nobody even mentions it. But, you know, was he really what he says he was? Where was he? And was he even in the POW camp? That's a big question because of what we will see, how he got out of there later. So we have to say here that it's highly unlikely that Avey could have found a Dutch Jew and persuaded him to exchange places for a day. To persuade someone to do something, you really have to spend some time. And he was not able to spend any time with these Jews, being a POW, a British POW. But A.B. says that he knew that they marched past each other at the same time every week. So then he says that the Nazis were rigid. To them, orders were orders to be carried out exactly. If the Nazis were rigid and orders were orders, then he could never have gotten away with the stuff he got away with. But he got away with it because somehow the Nazis were not paying attention at the very times that he needed them not to notice what he was doing. Because he tells us that he and this Dutch Jew marched past each other at the same time every week. And at the time that they marched past each other, their plan was that they would both sneak into a disused shed at the same time, swap uniforms, exchange places, go out and get in the other person's place. Now, were these marching groups just stopping there while they did this? Not likely at all. A.B. also says that he shaved his head and blackened his face before he did this. Well, let's remember, A.B. has red hair, his bright red hair. Lobenthal knew him only by the name of Ginger, he said. And the other prisoner would already have a shaved head because all the prisoners' hair was kept shaved to prevent lice. So you have a Dutch Jew with a shaved head joining the marching group of British POWs, and they didn't wear hats. They weren't allowed to wear hats, so there was no caps or anything. I don't think so. Now, when A.B. shaves his head, what happens to the guards amongst the British POWs when they see that he shaved his head? You're not able to shave your head. So that whole thing is totally improbable and impossible. And then he says he marched into Monowitz, a predominantly Jewish camp, and as we passed beneath the Arbeit macht free sign, everybody stood up straight and tried to look healthy. Well, we know that Arbeit macht free is Auschwitz. There is no Arbeit macht free sign at Monowitz. So he's confused between Monowitz and Auschwitz. What he is describing is Auschwitz, and he is, as he describes it further, he has marched to Auschwitz, which is 7 kilometers away from Monowitz, in the evening to spend the night at their barracks in Auschwitz. But as I've already pointed out to you, the Jewish prisoners who worked at Monowitz were housed at Monowitz. That started in 1942. They did not march to Auschwitz to spend the night and then march back again the next day. So this is really screwed up here. And then he says things like, after they went through the gate, there was an SS officer weeding out weaklings with a gas chamber, and overhead there was a gallows which had a corpse hanging from it. And the orchestra was playing Wagner, which was a chilling to him. While A.B. says here that he marched into Monowitz, but actually was in Auschwitz I, the BBC article said he fully intended to get as far as Birkenau, where the gas chambers and crematoria were constantly in operation, belching acrid fumes. But he only made it as far as Auschwitz III, which is Monowitz, where he spent the night on 2 occasions. So in the Times story, he marched into Monowitz, but he ended up in Auschwitz I. And in the BBC story, he was on his way to Birkenau, but he ended up in Monowitz. You know, this is all absolutely insane. And so now, continuing with the Times article, they were herded through the camp, he says, now he's in Auschwitz, carrying the bodies of those who had died that day. What does that mean? When did they all of a sudden find bodies of those who had died that day and they're carrying them? When did that ever happen? Then it quotes Avi as saying, I saw the Frauenhaus, the German's brothel of Jewish girls, and the infirmary, which sent its patients to the gas after 2 weeks. The Frauenhaus is not the name of the brothel. The brothel was called the Puff, and it didn't have Jewish girls in it because the Nazis did not allow Jews and non-Jews to have sex together. And the brothel in Auschwitz was composed of volunteer Polish women from the area. And I read that there's possibly some German prostitutes worked there too. But these women worked there. They were not taken from the camp. They were not working for free. And there were no Jews in that infirmary at all. So this is another thing that shows that this man doesn't know what he's talking about. He assumes all these kind of conditions that he thinks he can say and get away with it, but he doesn't know. He says that he committed everything to memory. This is more quote from him. We were lined up in the Appelplatz for a roll call, which lasted almost 2 hours. Then we were given some rotten cabbage soup and went to sleep in lice-infested bunks, 3 to a bed. Every word of this is false. They were constantly fighting lice in the camps, and particularly in Auschwitz. They were constantly using Zyklon B in these particular buildings that they used to delouse things and disinfect things. They had a huge disinfection program. That's what all the Zyklon B was for. So they weren't purposely putting prisoners into lice-infested bunks. That's why they shaved their heads. That's why they had their clothes changed every so often so that they could disinfect the clothing. So what he's saying you can prove, you can point out is not true. And, you know, Yad Vashem knows this. Yad Vashem, a lot of the things that he's saying here, Yad Vashem would already has acknowledged is false. And yet they're going to accept this testimony by him? I'm sure they are. Now, Avi describes the nighttime in Auschwitz. The night was even worse than the daytime. As it grew dark, the place was filled with howls and shrieks. Many people had lost their minds. It was a living hell. And then he says, everyone was clutching their wooden bowls under their heads to stop them getting stolen. Well, now here is where he says whatever pops into his head, because Scrapbook Pages guy makes a big point that they didn't have wooden bowls. That it was everywhere. They were always metal bowls. And that actually Schindler, who had the factory nearby, one of the things that he produced in his factory were these metal bowls for the concentration camps. And so here again, A.B. is just saying that without knowing, and therefore it says again that he wasn't there. Now, the thing is Lobethal. Lobethal had bribed A.B.'s bedfellows with cigarettes, he says. Now, when did this happen? Was Lobethal in the barracks that A.B. went to? There are very different versions of this with Lobethal. In some of the versions, it says that Lobethal was the prisoner with whom A.B. traded his uniforms and traded places. And so in that case, Lobethal would have gone to the POW barracks to spend the night. But in this Time story, which is the latest story, and I think the one that where they've tried to correct previous problems, Avi found a Dutch Jew to trade places with, and Lobethal is just a friend on the side who he is giving cigarettes to. He is not involved in this exchange, and Avi's visits to the Jewish barracks. So in the morning, A.B. says that he again complains, tries to put down the breakfast, saying it was black bread and a scrape of fetid margarine. Whereas, again, our friend, the Scrapbook Pages guy, says that that was the standard breakfast for all the German people. And you are not required to give better rations to your prisoners than you were to the regular population. whatever was normal for the people, that's what POWs were required to be given. And butter was rationed during World War II. Plus, Germany had a lot of trouble having enough fats, and they were always worried about the German people didn't have enough fats in their diet because Germany couldn't produce enough fats, and they weren't able to trade for fats. They didn't have good relations with the right people, so they had a lot of trouble. So therefore, they had to use margarine. Well, this was not something where people were being punished by being given black bread and margarine. Plus, if you were a worker, you got a second breakfast. Well, then he says, when they passed the shed again, this is in the morning, they marched back to Monowitz, all the way from Auschwitz, 7 kilometers. And when we passed the shed again, I slipped in to meet the Dutch Jew. You know, it's just like they just, as they're marching, these two guys jump out of the ranks, they go into the shed, they have to change uniforms and all, and then they get back out and get back in line. Unbelievable. So he says, then that's when he tells us that the Dutch Jew perished. And, of course, that's very convenient for him. Now, here's something where we know that Abe is making the story up, because he says that when the Soviet army was closing in on the camp, Nazis abandoned it and herded 60,000 prisoners, these were the regular prisoners, in the direction of Germany, and that he was among them. Well, the prisoners of war were not among the regular prisoners on the so-called death march. The POWs did not leave on the 18th when the prisoners left. They didn't leave until the 21st of January 1945. They were on a separate march. And if Avey was there, he would know that. And the fact that he says it differently shows that he's making this up. And why would he make this part up? It's unfathomable. And if people are doing research on this, why aren't they straightening this out? Well, you can't answer this because we have all these so-called witnesses who say ridiculous things, which can't be verified, and yet nobody has managed to fix up their story or tell them ahead of time not to say these things. So then another big problem is that he says that during the march, he managed to escape. If he was on the march with the POWs, he wouldn't be escaping because they were treated better and they were taking them somewhere and they wanted to account for them. But because he says he was with the regular prisoners, he found a way to escape, and of course many of them had died, etc. And he found his way back home all on his own to his Essex farm. But he says he went back to the Allied lines. He said he had TB by then. So if he had TB and he returned to the Allied lines, they would have put him in a hospital. They wouldn't have allowed him to wander on, find his way back to England. And then it says that he had a difficult life after that. He was hospitalized for 2 years after the war, he says. And why was he hospitalized? We know he lost an eye, so he suffered some injuries. But how, why, where, we don't know. He implies he was hospitalized for stress because he spent those 2 nights in Auschwitz. Now, here is this big, tough guy who was possibly in the special operations forces of the British military. And he talks about what a daredevil he was, how he was ready to do anything and everything and always had been. But he had to be hospitalized for stress because of 2 nights in Auschwitz. Plus, he says that he's never gotten over it. The author, Simon, says even today he shows signs of trauma. He writes that readjusting to normal life was hard for Avey. Avey became addicted to adrenaline, to racing fast cars, to traveling to Spain for the running of the bulls. Now, most veterans of World War II had no trouble readjusting to normal life after World War II. It's not like the more recent wars, the psychological problems that occur from that. They didn't have guilt about what they were doing. But Abe has had psychological problems for the rest of his life because of these 2 nights he supposedly spent in Auschwitz. And it said he always carries an expensive gold watch so that even if I ever find myself in a fix again, I've got something to fall back on. In short, he sounds like a very strange man. He sounds like someone who's always been rather odd. And I have, unfortunately, run out of time and can't go on about the program for the righteous among the nations. But it's my opinion that Lobethal gave his testimony, which I wasn't able to get to either. Lobethal gave a testimony to the survivors of the Shoah video library. And in doing so, he talked about this person named Ginger, who gave him some cigarettes and saved his life from that, because through that, as I said before, he was able to trade his cigarettes for shoes, and that saved his life. In saying this, he recorded this in 1995. So I think that Yad Vashem, they are always looking for special testimony that they can use for in their publicity, and they're looking for righteous Gentiles also, because it helps them when people from different nations, like in this case Britain, have some of their, you know, one of their race as listed in their righteous among the nations rose garden or whatever, and get a lot of publicity for it. So it helps to kind of bind the countries together. So I think when they heard Lobethal's testimony, they decided that this was a good story, and they were going to try to find this person who gave this, who did this for Lobethal and saved his life. And in doing so, they got the help of the BBC, because the BBC made the comment that they were the ones who reunited Lobethal's sister Susanna with Dennis Avey. And they're the ones who discovered, somehow Dennis Avey was discovered to be this person named Ginger. And then they put this whole thing together. To me, it's something that's been, as I said, contrived and put together for with a purpose. They found in this man, Avey, someone who was willing to lie, if he was a previous intelligence person, that goes along with that. And he's willing to say whatever, and his story is a little confusing, but they don't care, because they can put this out in the newspapers and they can put this out through the media, and people are only going to notice the emotional element in it, and they're not going to pay attention to the details. But we find that when we analyze these stories carefully and really look at them, we find almost invariably that they're made up of impossibilities, implausibilities, and plenty of untruths, and just basically propaganda. So that's my program for tonight. Next week I'm going to have a guest, a very wonderful guest, and I'm looking forward to that. I'm not going to say who the guest is yet, make sure that it takes place, but I hope you will be back with me next Monday for another episode of the Heretics Hour. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.